we're now up to him becoming a Gaon. We gave overview, we talked about his early life, we talked about his work Ha'egron, the dictionary that he wrote, we talked about his calendar controversy where he fought off the movement from Israel that would have split the calendar in the year 922-923. We're now ready for him to become the Gaon in Sura. So the every step of the way, Rav Sadia runs into trouble. There's always something going on. And this is no exception. Remember that we said when we first started talking about the Gaonim that the dynamic between the Reish Galusa, the political leader, the exilarch, and the Gaon was fraught. It was fraught in the times of the Gemara. There were already issues between the Reish Galusa and the Amorayim. So it doesn't get better in the time of the Gaonim. And the Reish Galusa, who is a fellow by the name of David ben Zakkai, makes him the Gaon in the year 928. And it seems like it's an outgrowth of what he did against Aharon ben Meir when the calendar controversy happened. There is some opposition because he was not native to Bavel. Remember, he was Egyptian, Rav Sadia. But that's okay. Where he runs into big trouble is the year 930, because there was some kind of a probate document involving an estate that David ben Zakkai, the exilarch, had title to. And Rav Sadia felt that it was not done properly. And the Gaon in Pumbedisa signed it, and Rav Sadia refused to approve it. And David ben Zakkai puts Rav Sadia into Cherem. Rav Sadia puts David ben Zakkai into Cherem. Each one claims to be deposing the other. So David ben Zakkai says, I'm appointing somebody new as the Gaon in the yeshiva in Sura. Sadia says, I'm appointing a new Reish Galusa. And basically, David ben Zakkai wins at that stage. And Sadia is on the outs until the year 937, in which there's some kind of a case that comes to a din Torah, comes to a base, and I don't know the specifics, but one of the parties concerned chose the Reish Galusa as a judge, and the other one chose Rav Sadia as a judge in this case. This is a system known as Zabla. The third chapter in Sanhedrin talks about the idea that when parties need to go to a Beis Din, they could choose to go to an existing Beis Din, but they could have each party choose not a representative, because the judge isn't supposed to represent them, but can choose a judge, and then the two judges will pick a third judge. And so these two sides each pick David ben Zakkai and Rav Sadia, and David causes the one who chose Rav Sadia to be abused. He's very upset, and that causes general consternation in the public, and finally the Jewish world forces a reconciliation between David ben Zakkai and Rav Sadia. It's the year 937. At this point, David ben Zakkai removes the opposing Gaon from office and puts Rav Sadia back into place, and things seem to have calmed down to the extent that when David ben Zakkai passes away, Rav Sadia actually appoints his son, Yehuda ben David, as his successor. Rav Sadia dies of an illness just 5 years later. So he doesn't really get a whole lot of time in that position. He only lives to be 50 years old to begin with.
The Gaon would appoint the Reish Galusa?
So that's what it looks like. That's what it looks like, at least had a major role in it. But the Reish Galusa appoints the Gaon. So, it's... yeah, it's an interesting dynamic for sure. It's not a clean process. That's pretty clear. So we've already talked about the Ha'egron dictionary. We're going to talk about some of his polemical works, the Sefer HaGaloi, his work against a fellow named Chivi HaBalki. We're going to have a lot to talk about, but I wanted to just grab quickly some of his texts that battled schisms and sects, and then jump into his campaign against ignorance, because that was a very big deal for Rav Sadia. But many of his texts are bent on specifically doing battle with schisms and different groups. We talked about the Isla Jews, the groups that arose that seemed to hybridize Islam and Judaism, as well as the Karaites. So Rav Sadia writes an Arabic translation of much of Tanakh, which we're going to come back to later on. He does an Arabic translation and commentary on Sefer Yetzirah, which is fascinating, right? Sefer Yetzirah being this major, early Kabbalistic work. So even though he's a rationalist, don't kid yourself. He's steeped in Kabbalah as well. He wrote Tshuvas, he wrote Responsa. He wrote commentary in Arabic on Rabbi Yishmael's 13 Midos that he uses to develop Torah Shebaal Peh. He had an Arabic work called Klalei HaTalmud, Principles of the Gemara, that's mentioned by the Chidah, Rav Chaim Yosef David Azulai, but we don't have that. And one thing that I wanted to show you that's particularly interesting, but we're not going to spend time on it really, is what I gave you in source number one. I did this years ago and thought I would just show this to you. This is printed, as you see, in his Siddur. It's a piyut. It is a poem of Rav Sadia, in which he finds the 613 mitzvos in the Aseres HaDibros. So I didn't bring you the actual piyut, the poem. I didn't bring. But what I show you here is how he puts each of the 613 in one of the Aseres HaDibros. So Rashi quotes this in source number two. I showed you Rashi on the pasuk that says that Tana l'cha es l'chos ha'eben v'atara v'amitzvah asher kasavti l'ho rosam. Hashem says to Moshe, I'm going to give you these tablets and the Torah and the mitzvah. So he says, kol shesh me'os u'shloshes v'mitzvahs b'chlal aseres hadibros hein. Rashi says, you can find all 613 within the aseres hadibros. V'Rabbeinu Sadia pirish ba'azharot sheyasad. Rabbeinu Sadia explained in his azharot that he composed. Azharot is the term for the type of piyut that this is. L'chol dibur v'dibur mitzvos atzliyos bo. For each of the mitzvah of the dibros, he showed you which mitzvos are connected to it. And what I did was I gave you some of the list in the middle of the specifics. It's clearly not all 613. And then I gave you in the left-hand column, I'm sorry that I don't have another copy for you, but the connection between the mitzvah and the one of the dibros and what the mitzvah is. So as an example, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, right? I am Hashem your God. So tzitzis and tefillin and mezuzah fit there, and you can see why. As I wrote in the left hand column, it's about remembering Hashem. They're all associated with remembering Hashem. He also has here love of Hashem, sanctifying Hashem's name, not testing God. Sneus, because it's Hatznei Aleches Im Hashem Elokecha, walking humbly or privately with Hashem, and so on and so on. And you could go through the whole thing. When I wrote this up, I did it for like a full shiur on the topic on a Shavuos night. But it's that type of thing is very Rav Sadia to do. It's this kind of encyclopedic thing, and he's trying to frame for you, for the reader, how Judaism works. That's really what he's offering us. And that leads us to his great crusade. He wanted to end Jewish ignorance of Judaism. He felt a lot of our problems come about just because we don't know enough. And he was very, very concerned about that. And so his emunos videos, beliefs and ideas, maybe you could translate it that way, I'm not so sure. The question is what the word deos actually means to Rav Sadia. A similar problem when the Rambam, one of his areas in Mishnah Torah, is Hilchos Deos. And it's not really about ideas, views, personalities, characteristics, unclear. But this work is meant to solve the problem of ignorance of Jewish thought. He writes a lot about Mashiach and Olam Haba. That was something that was very important in his formulation of what Jews need to know. And I gave you an example of it just because this is one that people always find interesting. If you look at source number three, it's building on a pasuk in Daniel, which I brought you first. I didn't bring the Hebrew because of Shemos issues. Daniel describes seeing a malach, an angel, as you see here, raising his right and left hands to the heavens, and he swore by Chei HaOlam, the life of the world, that in a time, times and a half, time, times and a half, and at the end of the crushing of the hand of the holy nation, all of this, meaning their exile, their suffering, the cycle of oppressors, all of that will end in a time times and a half. So everybody who got involved at all in thinking about Mashiach tried to figure out what that meant. Like, when is Mashiach actually coming? It led Abarbanel to predict the year 1503 and then 1504 and then 1505 as each year went. He said, well, you can tweak it a little bit and push it later. So Rav Sadia does this as well. If you take a look at source number 4, and I only brought to the English for two reasons. Number one, Emunos Videos is written in Arabic, so the Hebrew is not the original anyway. And number two, I wanted to fit a lot on the sheet. So the translation's my own, and the Hebrew Emunos Videos is very available. So look at what he does. He says, when it says in a time, right, it's going to happen in a time, times and a half, he says, that's only to introduce the words. That's like saying, I'm now about to tell you the time when this is going to happen. And he gives you an example which is the Shmos Chaf Gimel. So this would be a Mishpatim when we're talking about when Pesach is. So the introduction there, I think it's Bizman Chodesh HaAviv or something along those lines. It's not just B'Chodesh HaAviv, at the time of the month of Aviv. So he says that's not really part of the calculation. The essence is the words times and a half. So he says, I've investigated and I found that we should believe that the meaning of the word times is the years of the reign of Israel. Now remember, this is Daniel talking, right? So the end of that time will be once the years when the Jews had a kingdom. Full number plus half of that, and that's when it will be. So what is that calculation? So he says, by the time of Daniel, the Jews had had a kingdom for a total of 890 years. 480 years before the Beis HaMikdash is built, and 410 in the Beis HaMikdash. Even though it's true that for periods of time during that 480 years before the Beis HaMikdash was built, the Jews, at least in part, were living under Canaan or under Midian or under, we were not necessarily fully autonomous. Nonetheless, that's the period from Yetzias Mitzrayim, from when we got out of Egypt until the Beis HaMikdash was built, is 480 years, and then another 410 years in the Beis HaMikdash. So he says, do the math. 890 plus half of 890, which is 445, is a grand total of 1,335 years. So therefore, he says, you want to know when Mashiach is going to come? 1,335 years from the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. Now, when is the first Beis HaMikdash destroyed? So the classic Gemara chronology is the year roughly 300 and, the historian's chronology is 586 before the Common Era. The problem is the calculation of Chazal is different. I was mentioning the year for the second. The second Beis HaMikdash classically is somewhere around 350 before the Common Era. Then subtract 70 years earlier, so you get 420 before the Common Era, and then another 410 years before that. So the 410 years before that will be 830 before the Common Era. Right? Is that correct? I'm doing something wrong there.
Not based on your numbers. The math is right.
No, you know why? Because I was going back to before the first Beis HaMikdash. That's why. That's why I made a mistake. It's 350 and then it's 420 before the Common Era. That's what it would be. 420 before the Common Era will be when it was destroyed. I was going back to the year it was built. So from 420 BCE, you add 1,335. So you're now at... Yeah, just subtract. So 1,335 minus 420...
915, is that right?
No, 915 can't be. But that's the math, right? If the first Beis HaMikdash, according
to numbers...
1,335.
Minus
4...
No, that's correct. No, that's right. No, you're right. You're 100% right. That's right.
Yeah, 915.
Yeah, the 915. So his prediction is that the year, what time he writes this, is that the year 915 is going to be when Mashiach is
well,
going to arrive.
All right, so wait, he's then writing this, I'm assuming, after that time.
Oh, you know why? Because it's when Daniel has the Nevuah. Daniel doesn't have the Nevuah in the year when the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. It's not that he's saying it's 1,335 years from the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. It's 1,335 years from the year when Daniel is giving this prophecy. So that's what we don't know. We don't know what year of the Galus this was.
Prophecy.
Right.
What time of history is
it? Oh, it's in Galus Babel. It's during Daniel is speaking after the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, and he's in Babel. The question is only at which stage in Galus Babel.
That's going to be another 100-200 years onto this
calendar. No, somewhere less than definitely less than 70. The question is, can we narrow it further?
So he's predicting that in the near future.
Correct.
Near future.
He's predicting that it will be in the near future. That is.
But isn't there another part in this pasuk? And at the end of the crushing of the hand of the
Holy. No, because he's saying that's when that will happen. In other words, the crushing of the holy of the hand of the holy people is a reference to what we are suffering in our gullus. So this is when the end of that crushing will take place.
It doesn't add time. It isn't a minimum plus.
Right. No.
No.
That's not. I don't believe so. So the question will be more about our calculation of when the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, because Daniel and Tanakh in general are missing some of the Persian kings. And that creates questions about a missing period of about 160, 165 years. Rav Sadia does not get into in the least. So that's just, I bring that as an example of something that he feels it's important to put into what he's teaching Klal Yisrael. He spends a lot of time talking about Mashiach. His vision of what's going to be in Mashiach and Olam Haba is different from the classic one that the Rambam brings. I brought you one piece of this. If you take a look at source number 5, he says, people ask, will we die after this? In the time of Mashiach, do people pass away? In the time of Olam Haba, do people pass away? So he says, I respond that people will not die. They will be taken from the period of Mashiach to the pleasantness of Olam Haba. So there's a period of Mashiach. There's a different thing called Olam Haba, and people will go from the time of Mashiach into this Olam Haba existence. It's not a true death. And he says, regarding this, Chazal taught, those deceased people whom Hashem will revive will not return to their dust. That's it. There's no more death at that point. But he didn't only talk about Mashiach. He talked about Machshava overall thought. If you take a look at number 6, from the beginning of Emunos Videos, he says, Hashem, the one who knows without a cause, is the creator. Meaning, Hashem just knows. Everything there is to know at all, understanding all of existence, whatever, anything of it, that Hashem knows without having to learn it. But all created entities cannot know without a cause, and that cause is search and analysis. In order to know things, you have to learn. You have to study. And he's talking there about knowing about Hashem. Okay? To fulfill Anochi Hashem Elokecha, to know Hashem, you have to investigate. You have to learn. You have to engage in thought. And that's a big topic with him. That's a big topic with the Rambam as well. Comments on this before I feel like I'm rushing a little bit, because I cherry picked a line here and a line there, and I'm really doing it justice. I'm just trying to show a little bit about what it what it's like, what's in there. One thing that I thought is very interesting and worth some thought is his debate with the Rambam. And when I say his debate with the Rambam, you realize there's no debate back and forth between Rav Sadia Gaon and the Rambam. They're separated by centuries. But Rav Sadia Gaon teaches an idea which I think of as basically classic Jewish thought, which the Rambam was very much against. And that is the issue of anthropocentricity. The question of, are human beings the center of the universe? Are we the purpose of everything that Hashem created? We know that we're vital to the universe, right? The pasuk says, Hashem says, "Im lo brisi yomam v'layla, chukos shemayim v'aretz lo samti." If not for my covenant day and night, which we understand to mean Torah, if not for my covenant day and night, I wouldn't have set up the laws that govern heaven and earth. So it's clear that we are vital to the existence of the universe, right? We have this idea that if we don't receive the Torah at Har Sinai, Hashem says, then I'm just going to take it back to Tohu Vavohu. Go back to the beginning and try again. We say that when Hashem counts each day of creation, it's Yom Sheni, Shlishi, Revi'i, Chamishi, and it's Yom HaShishi. And the Medrash on that says that's the sixth of Sivan when we accept the Torah. Because that's when creation becomes set, so to speak. Never mind that the conclusion in the Gemara seems to be that we received it on the 7th of Sivan. But it was supposed to be the 6th of Sivan. Moshe added a day. Fine. But that's basic, that Torah is vital for the universe. But the Rambam, if you take a look at source number 7, in his Mora Nevuchim, and I took the Friedlander translation because that was cut and pasteable, the Rambam writes, "I consider therefore the following opinion as most correct according to the teaching of the Bible and best in accordance with the results of philosophy. Namely, the universe does not exist for man's sake. Each being exists for its own sake and not because of some other thing." What happens is, prior to this, and I was going to bring it on the sheet and then I wanted other things to fit, but prior to that line, the Rambam says, look, everybody agrees that Hashem could have created the universe any which way he chose, right? That's a given. Which means Hashem could have created human beings without all of these other creatures, right? They're not necessary for creation of, for the sustenance of human beings. Could be the African tree frog, Hashem didn't need to create it for our sake. We could have lived without African tree frogs. If so, says the Rambam, that must mean that they're really superfluous. Because if Hashem doesn't need them to support human beings, then they're not needed. Unless you agree with the Rambam that different things that exist not for our sake, but they have their own role in the universe. Not everything is about us. That's the Rambam's idea. It's the same thing as his statement regarding Malachim. The Rambam says that Malachim are not all there to do jobs that relate to human beings. Malachim have their own relationship with Hashem, their own knowledge of Hashem. They exist in this sphere way up, and in the beginning of Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, he talks about some of these Malachim, and they don't have a role regarding human beings. They're on their own. Rav Sadia Gaon was not a fan of this idea, and he expresses what I think of, again, as sort of classic Jewish thought on this point. He says, but his way of getting to it is interesting. He says, customary practice and construction, the way we build things, place the most honored element in the center of the elements that are not as honored. When you create things, you put the thing in the middle that's most important. That's what goes in the middle. We begin from the smallest things and note that a grain kernel is in the middle of all of the leaves. This is because the kernel is more honored than they are, for the plant's characteristics stem from it. I am not a botanist. I don't know the relationship between this and our understanding of how plants work. But he says the kernel of grain is encased in chaff, straw, because that's what's most important. It's certainly true. Leave aside the plant's characteristics. Maybe what he's referring to is the genetics of it, right? In order to perpetuate the species, you have to protect the kernel. So the kernel ends up being on the inside. The yolk of an egg, he said, is in the center, for the chick comes from there. I'm pretty sure that's not the case. The yolk is not where the...
The yolk is the sustenance.
Yeah.
The embryo is always on the surface of the yolk.
Yeah. So, okay. The human heart is in the... I mean, sustenance is important, but it's not the embryo. The human heart is in the middle of his chest, roughly speaking, because it is the dwelling of the spirit and of natural warmth. And as we see, he says, as we see this apply to most things, I have seen that the earth is in the center of the heavens, with the spheres revolving about it on all sides. This validates for us the earth is the goal of creation. And obviously, that's not...
There's a lot of rogue science here.
Yes.
I mean, I think almost everything possibly, but... He's getting at a philosophical.
Correct. And he says, we look at all of the earth's elements, we see the dirt and water are silent, the animals cannot communicate abstract thought, all that remains is man. So it must be, if earth is the most important, it must be the human beings that are going to be most important. And yes, the science of it really isn't the point. We use an expression, right, in the Gemara, that Yerushalayim is Tiburo Shel Olam, the navel of the world, which is complimentary, apparently. It's the center, it's what's considered to be what's most important. And then he goes on to say something of greater substance in Jewish philosophy, aside from the exterior design, interior design element. He says, God informed us via his prophets that he gave man an advantage over his other creations, and he quotes from Bereishis, the Yirdu b'digas hayam uva'ov ha-shamayim, the rain over the fish of the sea, and so on. He gave us the ability to serve him. He put the world before us, gave us control. He placed freedom of choice in our domain and instructed us to choose the good. And he quotes the Pasuk, I have placed before you today life and good, and so on. So he says, the fact that we have Bechira Chafshis, the fact that we have free choice, demonstrates that we are of highest importance, and therefore more important than a malach. Because malachim, we understand, as a general principle, even if there are some midrashim that create problems with this, as a general principle, we understand that malachim do not have free will. And if one will think that some non-human entity is more significant, let him show us the advantages or some of them which another creature possesses, for one could not find such a thing. He says, there's nothing. They're not higher than we are. So he writes.
The Rambam doesn't disagree with the fact that like humans are the only ones who can communicate, just that the animals are not there for the sake of the human beings.
Correct. The Rambam's point is that not everything that Hashem created is there to sustain human beings or because of human beings, but Hashem created things that have a role in and of themselves. This becomes very important, and I first came across this point of Rav Sadia Gaon versus the Rambam in an essay by Rabbi Dr. Lamb, going back to the 60s, about extraterrestrial life and the question of, could Judaism accept the idea that there's life out there in the cosmos that isn't about us? And his point was to say, if you accept the Rambam's philosophy, why not? Rav Sadia Gaon would have a harder time. Like, everything is supposed to come down to us. It has to interact with us in some way. That was the point of his... It was an essay he wrote in Tradition, you know, decades and decades ago. It's a very interesting question. That issue. I mean, there are sources in Judaism on extraterrestrial life going back centuries and centuries. It's not a new issue. Rav Kostek Kreshkish is the most famous in his Or Hashem, but there are others who discuss that. But this gets brought into that conversation as an example of something Hashem created, which could even be intelligent, and it might not be there for our purposes and because of us.
And what would that purpose be?
So that's a really good question. So then why? Why is that there? So when you're dealing with a malach, remember that the Rambam's idea of perfection is knowledge of Hashem. That to him is the ultimate goal. He's the pure intellectual. It's knowledge of Hashem. So when he comes to the malachim, he says they have their own access to knowledge of Hashem, which doesn't come about through engagement with us or through Torah. It's their direct, whatever direct means, exposure to Hashem in this celestial world.
Animals are very
popular. So animals, look, we talk about animals singing Shira to Hashem. So maybe on some level, in some other way, they have some perception, and that's what they're for, is to develop that perception. In which case, I would just borrow that over for the extraterrestrial life and say, then maybe they have some other access to. In other words, no one is going to believe within classic Jewish thought that there's another Torah out there and that they have a Torah of theirs. And their own set of mitzvos. There's one Torah, and that's all we get. Or two, if you follow Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, who say that Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh can be called two Torahs. But there's no... it's not that they have a Torah. They must have some other special, again, within the Rambam's thought, access to awareness of Hashem. That would be the idea. That's the best answer I can give. The Rambam does not discuss it.
They don't even need that. I mean, we don't understand what that could even be if it really existed. It would just be on its own. There is Torah, but it's not like a body is an effect of Torah.
Right.
Imagine having a relationship with Torah.
Right.
No today.
No, but he has the ability to access it. Right. In other words, he can convert. He can do, some being living in Alpha Centauri has no access to it. mean, you don't need to give the Rambam's approach in order to justify the idea that there's life out there. There are other ideas separate from that that can be brought into play. It's not, you know, yeah, the classic would be the Gemara in Chulin, Daf Samach, which says that Hashem creates the universe as a fully formed universe. Adam and Chava are created at the age of 20, and everything that Hashem creates, he doesn't create it as, a starting point and then let it age. He just creates it looking like a full-blown universe should look.
Right.
And if so, maybe that's what a full-blown universe has, is various civilizations.
But like, about what you just said, though, so but an animal doesn't have access to Torah.
Right. So the animal is not going based on Torah. The animal has, right, Shlomo HaMelech and Mishle, the animal has whatever innate wisdom is built into it. Yeah, well, that was what I said to Neil. Maybe that's some form of this idea that, yes, there's an access that isn't through Torah, but is something else. Yeah. But it's purely speculative. I don't know.
So it minimizes our purpose. Because it says that there is another purpose.
Yeah.
And if we aren't here, then there's another purpose.
Well,
because we have to stop. Right, so... No, because that's where you have to break it, because the Rambam acknowledges, and he writes it explicitly in Mishnah Torah, that the human being is vital for the existence of the universe. It's just that we're not the only purpose. In the same way, the comparison I always make, you have something that runs on batteries, right? So the battery is vital to the operation, but the thing wasn't created for the sake of the battery. The universe needs us to be learning Torah, fulfilling Torah. But that doesn't mean that that's the only goal of the universe.
Right, but as opposed to a battery therefore being thrown in the garbage, which has no purpose.
No, you're not supposed to throw them in the garbage.
Right, well, okay, but therefore if Torah was not in the world and human beings were not in Torah and the world was, so then all the animals and everything would be destroyed because of man's
I mean, go back to the Mabel, right? Go back to the flood.
Purpose.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's semantics then, what you mean by purpose.
In the world.
Purpose, I mean, ultimately the purpose is to support man's role.
There's
a second purpose, that there's man's role, but then if man isn't here, there's another purpose. So then what is that purpose?
So I'm not sure that I'm saying that it's all there to support man's role. I think the way that the Rambam would read it is that effectively it's actually flipped. The purpose of man is to enable this universe. By
being in Torah.
By being in Torah. Right.
It allows it to be in existence, which is needed for in and of itself something we don't necessarily understand.
In addition to the fact that for each of us, it brings us closer to Hashem, and therefore it serves our private purpose separate from the universal.
That's a separate argument about the existence of man versus everything else.
Right.
So it would be man's downfall that this universe that needed to be in existence in and of itself would be destroyed, it would be on man's, on him, so to speak.
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
Yes. I didn't intend to spend that much time on the Jewish thought part, because we tend to be more on the halacha. Talk about Rav Sajja going.
Rav Sajja did.
Yes, he did, and so did the Rambam. I'm not saying that to diminish the importance of it. I'm saying it just in terms of the fact that we usually have been sticking to halacha. But I wanted to. You can't talk about Rav Sajja without Emunos Videos. He was very concerned about lack of knowledge of Hebrew. That was a big deal for him, and we already talked about this somewhat with the Ha'egron dictionary of his. In his day, Hebrew was really beginning to recede because of merging with the culture around us, the Persian culture. We find, for example, not in Rav Sajja, but Rav Natronoigon, who we didn't talk about a lot. We mentioned him briefly. But he has a letter that they wrote to him asking him, would we be allowed to switch the Targum in Shul? Remember that from the time of the Mishnah, we find recorded that they did a Targum where they would translate after every Pasuk, Tupsukim, they would translate what had been said into Aramaic. So they wanted to know, can we do it in Arabic instead? Can we switch from Aramaic to Arabic? He said no. Rav Natronoi was not a fan. And I don't think that ever caught on. But that demonstrates what we're talking about in terms of their ignorance of Hebrew and more of their immersion in Arabic culture. And Rasaja writes about this very critically. However, at the same time, he publishes most of his work in Arabic, because he knows if you want to reach people, ultimately you have to write in a language that they have access to.
How does the Targum in Aramaic help people anyway?
So, before his time...
Like in Babel, yes, Aramaic makes sense then. So
correct.
Now, later on, we're just keeping the tradition of what I'm doing.
Right, so that's why they wrote not to. Why was there an insistence on keeping it? So there's an idea that the Aramaic Targum is more than just a translation. It is also something of a commentary. So, for example...
Was Unclus's Targum?
Correct. There were multiple Targumim.
Correct.
Unclus's one is the one that kind of won. But we have other Targumim out there, some of which we have in entirety, some of which we have in fragments. So
there's an elucidation.
To a certain extent, yes. To a very limited extent, but yes. Rasaja would have felt particularly close to it, because one of the things that Targum does is try to combat heresies. So the most famous example of this, I think, is the fact that every time Chumash seems to anthropomorphize God in any way, to give God any sort of human characteristic, so the Targum jumps in with an extra word or two or a change in order to fight that. So even something as basic as somebody spoke to God, he will say they spoke in front of God. Not that you speak to God. You don't speak to God. That's not a thing. They just little changes like that, and he would be very into keeping that. That would have been very very important to him. So just to show you the just to show you a little bit about this, and maybe we'll pick up with that next time, which will also end up being on Machshava, because we have to talk about his polemics. But he wrote the Targum that I mentioned, his translation of the Torah, which is into Arabic. Right? Again, despite his discomfort with the fact that Jews are ignorant, he says, well, they got to learn. So he writes this. It's called the Tafsir. I wonder if Tafsir is not connected to the word in Aramaic, Peter, Pei Taf Resh. I wonder if that isn't a switch of letters. I don't know. But he writes his Targum. Take a look at number 9. This, the Hebrew one, is Rav Kapach's translation from the Arabic into Hebrew, and then I translated Rav Kapach's Hebrew into English. So he says, I didn't write this text other than because some of the students asked me to separate the simple meaning of the Torah into a separate book. Without mixing in matters of linguistic usage, they get annoyed with my emphasis on diktuk, synonyms, antonyms, and borrowed terms. They don't want all of the technical scholarship, right? And I'm not going to bring in it either the questions of heretics or my responses to them, right, like I did in my polemics and in Munus Videos, and the branches of the rational commandments and how to fulfill the revealed commandments. I'll only translate the verses of the Torah exclusively. I'm just going to give you translation. That's what he says. However, don't kid yourself, he absolutely does, as they did in the Targumim, he does things to his translation in order to try to make it more in line with his philosophy. So, example, he avoids anthropomorphisms, just like in the Targum. He varies from direct translation, where he feels he can provide a clearer sense of the meaning and a smoother read. So, as an example, Sarah says when she wants Avram to get rid of Hagar and Yishmael, Lo yirash ben ha'ama hazos im bini im Yitzchak. Right? The son of this maid is not going to inherit with my son, with Yitzchak. And the Medrash talks about why she says with my son, and she also says with Yitzchak. But he just translates it as he's not going to inherit with Yitzchak. He leaves out im bini. He just omits it in order to make it a smoother read for people. Another interesting example of what he does when he angles things. In Parshas Va'era, when Aaron throws down his staff and it becomes a snake, right, or a tanin, whatever a tanin is, so it says also that the Chartumim, the sorcerers or whatever they are, of Paro, also throw down their sticks, and they also do that. Vayihyu l'taninim. So he translates it as they were like taninim, because he believes that the magicians were not able to do any of these things. There is no such thing as magic being able to do these things. Member of Saja is a strong rationalist. And so he says they can't do that. So he says they were like Taninim. That's a change that he makes. He also responds to specific claims, and we'll conclude with this, When it says Vayonach Bayom Hashevi'i, right? Hashem halted on the seventh day, but it sounds like he rested on the seventh day. So the Muslims were really angry about that pasuk because they took it as anthropomorphism. That is, you're saying God needs to rest.
The Muslims took it.
Yeah, the Muslims were very upset about this pasuk. They felt it was a way in which the Jews had altered what was the original text. So he translates it as Hashem didn't create any more of the things that he had created. Instead of translating it as he rested on the seventh, he actually changes it wholesale. In order to do that. For some of these things, I actually went back to the Arabic to do it. I took Arabic at YU, so I have sort of very rudimentary memory of it. But for this one, I wasn't able. For the other ones, I actually went into the Arabic and saw it. This one, I couldn't follow it. But that's what I have read as the commentary on his tafsir, that he actually did it with Vayonach Bayom Hashvi'i. He turned it into Hashem didn't create any more of the things that he had created. Instead. So what I want to do next time is talk about one specific polemic of his regarding a fellow named Chivi Habalki. It's fascinating. He's the village Am Haaretz. That's the way you'll see. You'll see what I mean with it. And then we'll see more of him in terms of halacha maybe, and then move on from Rav Sadia to Rav Shri Ragon and Rav Haigon. Okay. Thank you.